Last time we talked about speciation, and we gave you a couple of definitions of species. The first one was organisms that can mate and produce a viable, fertile offspring. The second definition that we talked about was organisms that share a common gene pool. And today what we want to start talking about is, what are some of the barriers to speciation? In other words, what are some of the things that keep organisms from being the same species? Well, there are really two different places where barriers to speciation can occur. The first is what we call prezygotic isolation mechanisms. Pre, of course, means before. Zygotic is a zygote is when the ovum and the sperm fuse together. So before fertilization, okay. And then we're going to talk about some postzygotic isolation mechanisms, meaning after fertilization occurs. Okay, so these first four are what we call prezygotic isolation mechanisms to speciation. The first one is habitat differences. In many instances, or at least in some instances, organisms may be able to cross. However, they never really do so because they live in different parts of the world or in different habitats. Okay. And so when organisms live in different habitats, they just never, ever meet up. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. There are quite a few, I guess you'd call them cow-like species that are found on the African continent. Okay. There's the true buffalo, the water wildebeest, a bunch of organisms like that. They can actually cross with domesticated cows and with animals that are found in the United States. However, they typically don't do so because they live in different parts of the world and they live in different habitats. We even have plants that actually, we have two species of plant, one that's found down here in the valley, one that's found up on the top of the mountain. If you bring them into a greenhouse, they can actually cross, and so that would indicate that they would be the same species, right? But they never really cross because they live in completely different habitats. And if you bring one from the top of the mountain down into the valley, it can't survive in the bottom of the valley. And the one in the bottom of the valley can't survive up on the top of the mountain. And so they just never really cross. Okay. Any questions about habitat barriers? The second one, the second prezygotic isolation mechanism we have listed here is different breeding times. Sometimes organisms don't cross just simply because they have different breeding times. If you were to artificially inseminate these organisms, or if you change their breeding times, they can cross, but they typically don't do so because of different breeding times. Again, just an example of animals in the southern hemisphere versus animals in the northern hemisphere. When do animals in the northern hemisphere, since we live here, when do they cross? Typically, like big game animals.
Spring.
Yeah, fall, right? Because why do they breed in the fall? Yeah, so the young will be born in the spring, and so then the young don't have to deal with harsh environments, or harsh conditions, I should say. Okay. Now, in the southern hemisphere, the seasons are just backwards from what they are in the northern hemisphere. So, for example, in the southern hemisphere, they're in the middle of the summer right now. Okay, and so the animals are basically 6 months off on their gestational periods and on their the time that they come into heat. And so sometimes animals just don't mate because they don't realize that they can reproduce at different times of the year. Maybe another example that we have here in Utah. Do all of you know what lake trout are? Have you heard of lake trout? They actually get really big. They live in really deep water, such as in Fish Lake and Flaming Gorge, those types of areas, and they can get really huge. They're great big fish. And then there's a fish called a brook trout. Well, you know what a brook trout is? It's kind of a common fish that we have in a lot of our mountain lakes and streams up on the mountain. They really have really beautiful coloration. Well, lake trout and brook trout, even if you put them in the same pond, they'll never cross. And the reason why is they have different mating times. What happens is with fish, as with many animals, what causes them to cross, or what causes them to go produce ovums and for the males to produce sperm, is actually length of day. So they actually determine what time of the year it is by how long the sun is up, essentially, okay, or how long the dark period is, however you want to think of it. All right, and so what happens is they're off about 3 months in their breeding cycles, the brook trout and the lake trout. Okay, so in nature they never ever cross. However, you can get them to cross artificially. And they actually do this down at a fish hatchery down in Loa called Egan Fish Hatchery. It's a state-run fish hatchery down there. And what they do is they actually put lake trout males in a big old tub, essentially, with a lid on it. And what they do is they change the day-night cycles by using just artificial light. Does that make sense? So they have these lights, they turn on and turn off at different periods. And so what they do is they trick these males into believing that it's a different time of the year than it really is. And so they start to produce sperm when the brook trout females are producing eggs. And then what they'll do is they'll take the males and milk the sperm from them, kind of cross those eggs, make that cross in a, it's not really a petri dish, but in a bucket, okay? And they produce a viable offspring, however it is infertile. It's called a tiger trout, if any of you have ever heard of tiger trout. And that's how they produce them. Tiger trout don't occur in nature because those two types of fish have different breeding times.
So all the tiger trout you catch are planted?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And they're also different species for another reason, a polyzygotic isolation mechanism. The tiger trout are infertile as well, but there are some crosses with fish that they've done, such as the brook bow. They don't produce those very much anymore. They're fertile.
Isn't it brown?
Yeah, brook bow is a. Or is it brown bow? I can't remember. One of the two. It's
no, I mean brown trout. Right?
Brown trout are native. Yes. Yeah, they're a true species. The other one that's artificial cross or splake that you might have caught, splake trout. Sometimes there are mechanical barriers to speciation. Probably, maybe just let me kind of give you an obvious example. A horse and a poodle are different species. Now, all of you can kind of understand that. They look very different and so forth. But if a male horse tried to mate with a female poodle, it just is never going to happen, right? Because there are mechanical differences. The genitalia just are not going to fit, right? Now that's an obvious one, all right? But there are some that might not be so obvious. For example, in beetles, a lot of times the only way that we can tell different species of beetles is by actually boiling out the genitalia and looking at the genitalia underneath a microscope. Because in some beetles, they may look very similar, but in one species, the male may have a penis that looks something like this. It's kind of square-shaped. In another species that looks very similar, it may have a penis that is kind of circular with a different shaped head. Okay. The females of these species are going to have what? Their genitalia are going to have evolved so that these male genitalia will fit, right? So if you have a female genitalia that would normally fit this type of male genitalia, then this particular type of male is not going to be able to mate with it because its genitalia are just not going to fit. Does that make sense to everybody? So that's a mechanical barrier. Sometimes genitalia just don't fit. All right? In other words, mating is impossible or crossing is impossible. Any questions about that? The last type of prezygotic isolation, the last prezygotic isolation mechanism we're going to talk about is behavioral specificity. Okay, sometimes animals just don't behave properly, and so they just don't cross. Right? Let me give you an example of this. In Utah, we have some birds that are called sage grouse. Some of you have probably heard of sage grouse. There's some of them out in some specimens out in the
skyline
cabinet out here. Okay, you can look at. But in Utah, there are a number of different populations of sage grouse. There's a population in Wayne County and Paiute County, down in the Parker Mountains, which is the largest population of sage grouse in the state. There's one up here in the Uinta Basin. There's actually one kind of by Strawberry. There's one in Summit County, okay, Colville area. And then there's a population up here in the corner of the state by Utah and Nevada. And then there's a population of sage grouse that occur down in the Monticello area of the state. Now, sage grouse have been studied quite extensively. One of the reasons why is because many of our populations of sage grouse are disappearing, okay? They're going extinct locally. And so scientists and legislators and so forth have been quite concerned about sage grouse populations. I should mention there's one population out here, it's a real small one out in the West Desert. Scientists have been really concerned because some of these populations, the numbers of birds are going way down and almost locally going extinct. For example, the one in the Strawberry Valley, the birds just keep disappearing. There's a real problem with sage grouse in the Strawberry Valley. This one in the West Desert, populations are decreasing. And the one that's really of a lot of concern is the one down in the Monticello, out into the Colorado area. This particular population of sage grouse is almost disappeared. Okay, there's a real worry about them going extinct. And so if you have all these different populations of sage grouse and you have some populations that aren't doing very well, then the obvious fix is to do what?
Transport.
Yeah, transport birds from healthy populations. For example, this population right here, and this one here, and this one here, they're all growing. Okay. In fact, this population on the Parker Mountain, you can even hunt sage grouse down there because there's just so many sage grouse. Okay. So the obvious fix would be to what? Transport birds from here into these populations that aren't doing so well and kind of augment those populations, transplant them, right? Well, they've tried doing this over the last, 20 years. And what they find is that they can transport birds from these populations and transport them into any of these northern Utah populations, and the birds will cross. However, when they transport birds from the Parker Mountain down into the Monticello area, the birds don't cross. Okay? And so what we think is that this is a different species of sage grouse down in the Monticello area. They call it the Gunnison sage grouse because of Gunnison, Colorado. There's a town called Gunnison, Colorado there. This is called the Gunnison sage grouse. And one of the major differences between the two sage grouse, there's a little bit of visual difference. I mean, you can kind of tell the difference if you look at them from a physical perspective. But more importantly, the reason why they won't cross is because they don't behave properly. Okay? The greater sage grouse, which is what we have through most of Utah, when the sage grouse, when they get ready to mate, the males will strut around and they do a dance, and they all dance and beat their chests and make all these cool noises. And if you've never seen it, you guys really need to get up and go see some sage grouse mating. It's really super exciting. I take my majors classes down to the Parker Mountains every year, and they're always amazed at the birds. They do this little dance. Well, what happens is the females of the Gunnison sage grouse don't recognize the dance of the greater sage grouse, and vice versa. Okay, and really, it's not that different of a dance. The greater sage grouse do like a two steps left, two steps right, two steps left type of a dance, whereas the Gunnison sage grouse males, they do two steps left, one step right, two steps left, and the female Gunnison sage grouse won't mate with the greater sage grouse males because they don't dance right. Seriously.
Is that what the sandhill cranes are doing that always come out west of Ethan when they do their little dance? Is that the mating?
Yeah, it's a mating dance. And so, you know, really, sometimes you have to behave properly. Spiders are very similar. Male spiders, if they don't stroke a female just right, if they make one wrong move, they get eaten before they get to mate instead of after. Okay? And so in a lot of organisms, behavior in treating the female the way she wants to be treated is just as important as any other part of the mating process. Okay? Any questions about behavioral specificities? Okay, let's talk about some postzygotic isolation mechanisms. There are three, and we've already talked about most of these postzygotic isolation mechanisms. There's hybrid inviability. This is when the young don't survive. Sometimes fertilization can occur between organisms, but the young just don't survive. In other words, there's too much of a chromosomal difference most of the time, and the young die before they're born. There's too many problems with it to actually develop properly. We've talked about the second one there, hybrid sterility. Hybrid sterility is when the offspring between the two species is viable, but they're not fertile, and so they can't produce offspring. We gave you a couple of examples. I'll give you even one today. The tiger trout, the liger, the mule, those are all examples of hybrid sterility. Now, somebody made mention of some fertile mules, and every once in a while, most of the time in mules and other hybrid sterile offspring, every once in a while you'll get a fertile offspring. Okay, and the same is true with mules. I think it's like something like 1 in 10,000 mules are fertile or something like that. Okay, so it's a very, very low chance. But if those mules that are fertile mate with either a horse or a donkey or another mule that's fertile, regardless of who they mate with, their offspring are always infertile. Okay, and that's what we call hybrid breakdown. So if there is a fertile hybrid every so often, their offspring are always infertile, and that's why we call it hybrid breakdown. So they, you never get past the second generation. Yeah.
Do they try to mate?
Do infertile organisms try to mate? Yeah. They can try.
It's like if you have a steer, they won't try.
Yeah.
So I just wondered.
Well, that's because they've basically eliminated their intestines. That's why steers don't try to mate. But yeah, mules will. Any questions about postzygotic isolation mechanisms to speciation? Okay, this will be the last material that will be on the test tomorrow. Okay, so the rest of what we talk about today will be on the following exam, right? The next topic that we are going to talk about is kind of a continuation of what we've just been talking about, and that is of species and of classification of organisms. The science of classification of organisms is what we call taxonomy. Okay. So when we talk about taxonomy, that is the science of naming or classifying organisms. And most people are interested to some extent in taxonomy. I get people all the time that will bring me all sorts of animals and plants, and they'll say, what is this animal called, or what is this plant called, right? Everybody seems to think that there needs to be a name for all organisms, which is really the reason why we have taxonomists, or organisms that classify organisms, or scientists that classify organisms, excuse me, okay? Now, in the taxonomic hierarchy, there are a number of different levels. The first is what we call the domain. And your textbook talks about the domain. And then we have what we call kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. Okay. Now we're gonna, I'm gonna introduce the idea of domain, and then we're also going to talk about why the domain system is sometimes not the best system to use. But generally when we talk about this domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, this is what we call the taxonomic hierarchy. Okay? And I'm gonna talk a little bit about how this taxonomic hierarchy works here, all right? So this is what we call a taxonomic hierarchy. This is at the species level. This is the most specific classification of an organism. At the domain level, that is the least specific classification of a group of organisms. Right. So the way that my biology teacher help me to remember the taxonomic hierarchy is by using a mnemonic device. We didn't have domain back then, and it's still somewhat debatable as to whether or not there should be a domain. So he told me to use this mnemonic device. He says, "Kings play chess on fine grained sand." Okay, that's the first letter of each of the taxonomic hierarchy. So when we talk about this taxonomic hierarchy, as I mentioned, it's going from less specific to more specific as we move down the taxonomic hierarchy. For example, we could classify where humans fit in the taxonomic hierarchy. And let me give you some examples here. First of all, there are two domains. There's the archaea and the eukarya. And we belong, the animals belong to the eukaryotes, okay? So we're the eukarya. As far as kingdoms are concerned, there are a number of eukaryote kingdoms, okay? There is the kingdom Animalia, and that's the one that humans belong to. There's also the kingdom Plantae, the kingdom Protista, and the kingdom Fungi. Okay. And so what we're doing here is we're saying, okay, there are some differences between organisms. Animals are very different from plants, for example, right? What makes animals different from plants? We've already talked about that a little bit.
Cells.
Okay, the way that the cells are put together, right? Plant cells have cell walls, and they have a larger vacuole. They have chloroplast, typically, okay? And so... And animals don't have cell walls, they don't have chloroplasts, so animal cells are different from plant cells. So what we're doing at this point is we're saying, okay, at the kingdom level, we're going to, one way of kind of visualizing this is saying, okay, we're going to get five big boxes, okay, or four big boxes, and we're going to put all of the organisms into these huge boxes, kind of classify them. So what we do is we look at the organism, well, if it has plant-type cell walls, we throw it in the plant box, right? If it has animal types of cells, we throw it in the animal box. Does that make sense? So you're kind of separating them out depending on characteristics that the organisms have. All right? Any questions about that? So if we take just the kingdom Animalia, there are a number of phyla within the kingdom Animalia. Now one thing that I should mention here is that in plants and fungi, we don't use the term phylum. Biologists use the term division in plants and fungi, but it's basically the same as phylum. It's just a little bit different terminology that's used in plants and fungi. But with the animals, let's think about different phyla of animals. What does anybody know what phyla the human belongs to, by chance? What? Yep, somebody said that. I heard a word on it. We belong to the phylum Chordata. What other types of organisms are there out there besides chordates? What?
Mollusks,
okay. Mollusca. Mollusca includes like your octopods, squid, clams, snails, okay? And what else can you think of? What about arthropoda? Arthropoda includes like your spiders and insects and their allies, okay? Another phylum is Annelida. Annelida includes like your earthworms, your leeches, okay? So really what we're doing here, kind of one way of thinking about this is, remember we had a big box with all of the animals that's going to be in this big box. Now if you can kind of imagine, within this big box, there's smaller boxes, okay? And each one of those smaller boxes represents the phylum level of organization. And what we do at this point is we say, well, some animals, like humans, have a notochord, a dorsal tubular nerve cord, and some other characteristics that we'll learn a little bit later on this semester. Anytime those organisms have those characteristics, we put them in the chordata box, okay? If an organism has an exoskeleton of chitin, we put them in the arthropoda box. If they have a mantle, we put them in the mollusca box. If they are segmented worms, we put them in the annelida box, okay? So, and there are a number of other phyla besides the ones that I've listed up here that we're going to learn this semester. And so within this big animal box, there's a number of smaller boxes. So we're more tightly defining the organism as we move down the taxonomic hierarchy. Any questions about that? Okay. So then, within the phylum Chordata, within the box that contains all the chordates, we can break them up into smaller boxes or smaller units, into what we call the class level. We actually belong to the class Mammalia, and what do all mammals have? Most of you know this already. They all have hair and mammary glands. That's where you get the name of Mammalia, okay? So, other mammals would include what? What are some other mammals? Speak up.
Apes,
horses, cows, bats, right? They're all mammals. But there are other chordates besides just mammals. There is a class of chordates that is what we call the aves, which are the what? Birds. Okay, so all of the aves have feathers. There's another class that is the class Reptilia, commonly what we call the reptiles. Okay, and then there's another class. Okay, and there are some other classes that we'll talk about a little bit later on in the semester. So what we're saying now is that within the chordata box, we're more similar as humans to a cow than we are to a bird. Okay. We're more similar to a whale than we are to a snake, okay? We're more similar to a bat than we are a frog. Any questions about that? Okay. Within the mammals, there are actually a number of orders. We belong to the order primates. Now, primates includes organisms such as your apes and monkeys, chimpanzees, so forth. Okay. There are other orders of mammals. For example, there's one called the Carnivora, which are your dogs and your cats and bears, those types of organisms. There's another order called Rodentia, the rodents. Okay. Another order, Lagomorpha, which are your rabbits, so forth. Okay. There's a whole bunch of other orders of mammals that we haven't mentioned here. What we're saying now is within the mammalia box, we're going to have a bunch of smaller boxes. And what we're saying at this point is that we're more similar to a lemur than we are to a dog. Or we're more similar to a chimpanzee than we are to a mouse. Okay? Any questions about that? Now within the order primates, we belong to the family Hominidae. There's also the family, the ape family, the chimp family, the What else? The baboon, family, and so forth within the primates. So we belong to the family hominidity. So what we're saying now is that we're more similar to other hominids, which there are none that are extant, than we are to an ape. Okay. Now I used a new term here, extant. What does extant mean?
Exist.
They're alive. It's the opposite of extinct. Okay. So we are the only species within our family that is extant right now. Okay. All of the rest of the species within our family are all extinct. Does that make sense? For example, there was Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Astropithecus, a bunch of other early humans, I guess you could say. Okay. Any questions about that? Our family is kind of weird because there's only one extant genus within our family, and that's the genus Homo. Okay. So all of you belong to the genus Homo, so regardless of what anybody says, we're all homos. Right? That's the way you can remember it. Okay. So we all belong to the genus Homo. We belong to the species, and actually there are a number of species within the genus Homo, but our species is Homo sapiens. Okay. So that's our species name, is Homo sapiens. There are some other species that are extinct, such as Homo erectus, Homo habilis, and so forth. Okay. Now you'll notice that the species name is what we call a binomial. Species names are always two names. The genus name, okay, and what we call the trivial name or the species name. Alright? So they're always a binomial. Also, you'll notice here that the genus name is always capitalized. The species name is always lowercase. Okay? And when you write a species name, it is either underlined or italicized. Alright? Any questions about that? Now, I know that's fairly technical, but this is one of the things that biologists use to kind of weed out whether or not people know something about biology. I've actually hired technical writers or helped, been on committees to hire technical writers for biology companies, and they always get the technical writers to write species names. And one of the things that they did, that we did when I was helping with this search, so we went through and looked at the species names that they had written. Everybody that wrote it properly got put in one stack. Everybody that wrote it improperly got put in another stack, and we never saw those people again. Okay. So it's kind of, every field kind of has their own little pet peeves, I guess you could say. And this is one in biology. So even if you're not going to be a biologist, you might work with biologists, and it's something that's important to know. So species names are binomial, a genus and a species. The genus name is always capitalized, species name always lowercase, the name is always underlined or italicized. Okay? Now if there's a subspecies, you would also write it lowercase out here and either underline or italicize it. Okay? Now the reason why it's a binomial is because many organisms have the same trivial or species name. And so the only way that you can distinguish between two different groups of organisms is by looking at the genus name along with the species name or trivial name. All right? Let me give you an example. Around here, around Ephraim here, we have two plants that have the same species name or trivial name. They both have the species or trivial name of Tridentata. And one of the things I should mention about these genus and species names as well is they are all Latinized, okay, which means that they usually mean something in Latin. One of the kind of the interesting things, if any of you decide to become biologists, if you're a biologist for long enough, you can start to pick up Latin texts and read through them and kind of understand what's going on in Latin texts, because all these words actually means something in Latin. Okay, for example, tridentata refers to leaf. It means that they have a trident leaf, which means that the leaves of these plants are actually going to have three different bumps on the leaf. Okay, does that make sense? So, which is kind of interesting. So, the one species with the species or trivial name of Tridentata is Artemisia. Artemisia Tridentata is sagebrush. Okay, all of you know what sagebrush is, right? And another species with the same species name or trivial name is one that's called Persia Tridentata. It's also a shrub. It's one that's commonly called bitterbrush. So if, as a scientist, I were to just go out and I were to say to another scientist, look at that Tridentata plant, okay? They would look at me like I didn't know what I was talking about because, right, there's more than one species that has the genus or the species name of Tridentata. Any questions about that? So species names are always a binomial, right? And around here, we actually have a number of subspecies of sagebrush. There's Artemisia tridentata tridentata, which is basin big sagebrush. There's Artemisia tridentata vasiena, which is vasiena big sagebrush. There's Artemisia tridentata wyomingensis, which is Wyoming big sagebrush, and they're all different subspecies. Any questions about species names or the taxonomic hierarchy? So when we're looking at the taxonomic hierarchy, we are actually going from less specific to more specific as we move down the taxonomic hierarchy. Now on this table here, they actually, because of space, they put the genus and species name on separate lines. But for example, in the killer whale, it's Orca orcinus, okay? So they belong to the kingdom Animalia, the phylum Chordata, class Mammalia. So that the whale, up to this point, has the same classification as a human, right? Okay. But then at the order level, they belong to the order Cetacea. They belong to the family Delphinidae and the genus Orca, okay, and so forth. Any questions about that? Okay. A lot of times, scientists use what we call the five kingdom scheme of classification, and I'm going to kind of get you to, hopefully you will learn two different schemes of classification. The five kingdom scheme is what we're going to use a lot of the time, and then there's also the one with three domains, okay? The way that your book classifies organisms is they have six kingdoms and three domains, all right? They actually have the domain Archaea and the domain Eubacteria, which are both prokaryotic organisms. If you remember, prokaryotic organisms have no membrane-bound nucleus, no membrane-bound organelles, right? And then we have the domain Eukarya, which are your eukaryotic organisms. In other words, their cells have a membrane-bound nucleus and a membrane-bound organelle. We'll talk about the differences between Archaea and Eubacteria on another day. But a lot of times, kind of another way of classification, kind of an argument between scientists is whether or not to classify them in three domains or just take all of the prokaryotic organisms, put them together in one kingdom. And that's where we get the five kingdom classification. Notice we have Protista, Plantae, Animalia, and Fungi. In the domain system, we have Protista, Fungi, Plantae, and Animalia. They're all the same as far as the kingdom level. But notice here, in the five kingdom classification, we have just one kingdom called Prokaryota, or another name for it is Monera. Okay. That I'll use. Whereas in the domain classification system, there are two different domains that kind of split the Monera or the prokaryotic organisms apart. Okay. Now you might ask yourself, well, why can't scientists make up their mind? And all use the same classification system. You wondering about that? The answer is because no matter how you classify organisms, there can always be an argument. Okay? Argument among scientists. And the reason why is because our classification systems are basically artificial classification systems, right? If you think about it. In other words, do two animals care what their taxonomic classification is? I mean, if they can mate, they're going to mate, right? Okay. They don't really care what their taxonomic classification is. But as humans, we kind of have to put these organisms in artificial boxes so that the world makes sense to us and organize them. And so all of these classification systems are somewhat artificial. And that artificial, those artificial characteristics are defined by humans, and therefore, since they're defined by humans, there can be arguments between humans as to which characteristics should be the most important, etc. Does that kind of make sense? So there's many times arguments between scientists on how to classify organisms. All right. Any questions about that? Okay. On Wednesday, we are going to talk about the characteristics of the kingdoms of organisms. We're going to define the kingdoms a little bit more tightly. And then we'll talk about a group of organisms that we haven't mentioned within our taxonomic hierarchy, as well as maybe get into the prokaryota, okay, or the bacteria. Any questions?